It's Klaatu, and this is the New World Order, episode 2 of season X. Great show planned for you today, some discussions, some demos, a tip in response to some listener feedback. So because of the format change, the introduction of the video version of the show, I have to admit that it's a lot more difficult to respond directly to listener feedback, which pains me. I really would rather respond to listener feedback, you know, read email, stuff like that, which I did previously on the audio-only versions, but simply because of how the videos are recorded in advance and then they have to get edited in time, so it's by the time I'm shooting a video, by the time one is released, rather, I have already shot the next one, so listener feedback would always be months behind. It's just not worth it. In this case, however, I've accumulated a couple of different feedbacks nevertheless, and so I can kind of respond to them anyway. So I'm not going to read the emails because the emails have been and gone. You know, I've had that conversation, and I can't keep track of that stuff anyway, but I do have some things that I want to pass on and respond to in terms of listener feedback. But first, of course, it is time for the fortune of the day. It's Bowling's postulate. If you're feeling good, don't worry, you'll get over it. That's pessimistic. I don't like that one. But that's what we get. It's a fortune. Okay, so the first thing that I want to talk about, it's based on some commentary back and forth in email. And one of the things that I said in the previous episode was that the education system isn't really teaching people how to compute. It's just teaching people how to press buttons. I've touched on this before in this show, in the audio version, past seasons. And it's something that I firmly believe, and it's one of those things that I don't really need to convince myself of. I don't need to really hold on to it. I mean, I would like for it to be incorrect, for it to be wrong. And I think every time I encounter the educational system, whether it's from working within it, which is what I did at my last job, or just being around it as I am now, because of other people in my life who are around the education system, it just keeps getting reinforced that schools aren't, and even not school, I mean, it doesn't have to be about public schools or anything like that. It's also like adult education programs, you know, that are out there that are trying to teach adults better skills so that they can get better jobs or whatever. I don't imagine that there's a conspiracy or anything like that. It's just, I mean, I understand that the people who do reach out and teach people, they're doing the best that they can do very frequently. Not all the time. Sometimes it's just a gig and, you know, it's just babysitting, but very frequently it's people who are genuinely interested in this stuff and are trying, and they don't know as much as maybe they should to ideally teach, which, again, I mean, it's hard to criticize people who are doing it genuinely out of an interest to impart knowledge. So I'm not trying to make a blanket statement or anything like that. I'm just saying that in my experience, education systems tend to focus very much on specific anticipated models of something that you are going to need to do when they teach you how to do something. You know, it's I don't know. Going back to the desk analogy from the previous episode, you want to build a desk, right? So you build a desk. This is not a desk that I built, as I stated. But, I mean, if you go and learn exactly how to build a desk, then that's all you're ever going to be able to learn. And if you instead go and learn how to, you know, all the details about carpentry and stuff like that, then you can basically build anything you want, I guess. I don't know. That's probably a bad analogy because I don't really know that much about carpentry myself. But you get the idea. It's the old saying, teach a man to fish and he eats fish, or something like that. Teach a man to eat fish and he fishes. So what I want to address in this one, a little bit more broadly than just like education, is the concept of change and the modern world and you. And this kind of encompasses the first stuff too, right? Because I was talking about System D, which is a big scary change for a lot of people. Again, as I stated, I don't know if it's a necessary change. I really don't. I have a comment about that later as well. Very cool tip. But anyway, System D is out there. It's in the wild. People fear it because it means that they have to learn something new and it's different. Or it just annoys them. I mean, I'm not trying to insult people who don't like System D validly. I'm just saying that there is a contingency of the Linux-using population that simply doesn't like System D because it's inconvenient. And a lot of us, I think, we claim that we want something new, but we don't really want something different. So here's what I mean by that. And I don't mean what you think I mean. Like tablets and phones, those are brand new, really. I mean, when did the iPhone come out? 2004? 6? I don't know. Whenever that came out, that really was a new thing. To my knowledge, I don't know of an interface quite like that. I think that was a game changer. And I could be wrong. I mean, you can argue prior art all you want. I'm totally open to it. It doesn't have to be the iPhone. But I'm saying that was a new interface. It was a new way to interact with a handheld device. And prior to that, I mean, we had like, I remember I got the N800, the Nokia N800. I think I traded an iPhone for it because I had gotten an iPhone for some reason. And I literally went on Craigslist and posted that I would trade someone a Nokia N800 for an iPhone. And I did that, and it was well worth it. I never regretted it, not for a moment. But I mean, I admitted then, and I admit now, that the interface of this handheld device was really, really clunky, really not very good. It was highly dependent upon a little plastic stylus, which I was sure I was going to lose. I never did. And then it would encourage you at other times to use your fingertip because they're big, big buttons, but then other times they would be tiny and you'd have to like use the sliver of your fingernail to try to kind of like do things. It was really clunky. So there was like this new thing that happened with mobiles, and Android took that way to the next level. I'm talking like light years ahead, with, you know, the ability to do things like copy and paste and multitask, little things like that. But it was a new interface. People bothered learning how to use those items, like the mobile interface, because it was brand new. It was not different. It was new. There was nothing preceding it. I mean, sure, there were like those old style, you know, clamshell cell phones, but I mean, that was basically a menu system. I mean, that's what they were. They had an up and down arrow and an enter and a back, and that's how you navigated everything. It was very, very traditional. So I'm going to argue that that was not new, whereas the touch interface on mobiles, there was almost no precedence for it. It was just something brand new, and so people could learn that because they didn't have to unlearn anything else. That's what I'm trying to get to. So, I mean, this is almost not a debatable point. I mean, you could debate it, but really, I mean, think about it. Windows XP has been around for a long time, and I still see posts on forums and even in like a group of technical, a technical group that I'm associated with, some people in that group, full of technical minded people, some people are still using XP. I mean, I'm talking, it's really persistent. And look at, you know, the newest versions of Windows, even, well, 8 specifically. I mean, a drastic new interface from what I understand. I don't know one from the other. And it's completely, I mean, people don't want to touch it. They don't want to go anywhere near it. So that's people resisting change and people welcoming something completely new with whatever interest level they have in that thing. I mean, I'm sure that there's some kind of basic need that a mobile device serves. I don't know, but I'm assuming that people wouldn't have learned it if they didn't find it useful. But they did learn it, and it wasn't because they had to unlearn something else. It was because they got to learn something brand new. Now, I challenge you to develop a mobile interface now that deviates from the pattern that has been set forth by the leading mobile companies that exist now. You know, if you come up with something completely different, like if I haven't used Firefox OS or Sailfish or any of those other alternate OSs for mobiles, but I mean, if they were completely different, I mean, they would be dead in the water. So, who to blame for this kind of this idea that something that you learn once is going to persist for the rest of your life? Again, I do tend to blame the educational systems across the globe. I used to think it was just an American thing, but here in New Zealand, I'm seeing basically the same thing. And people are taught computers as basically a static tool set, and they're taught one tool per task, and they're never shown alternatives. Much less are they ever shown how to create solutions of their own. So why should anything ever change? You got taught this thing. You got taught maths and grammar and computers. Maths and grammar don't change, so why should computers change? You know, I mean, it all gets kind of lumped up into the same sort of expectation. You know, we are all expecting the computers to be a static tool set that we never have to relearn. We learned it once. We don't learn how to ride a bicycle twice. We don't learn how to drive a car twice. You know, all these things. It's just, no one ever tells us that this one thing that we're getting taught is malleable and subject to change. And what tools do the educators even really provide? You know, I mean, it took me, and this is, I've been interested in computers my entire life. I didn't always admit that I was, but I was. I've been using computers my entire life. It took me until Linux to even understand that I personally had the ability to write my own tools on a computer. I mean, I knew, you know, around university time, I kind of knew that it was theoretically possible. I figured there had to be ways to automate things. I mean, that just felt like a computer should be able to do that. I don't think I ever imagined that I would be able to write an application that I could use and, you know, like, actually use, like, depend on. And at this stage in my life, I've got several tools that that I have written that I basically depend on. You know, I mean, it's like, if I don't have some of my applications on a computer, it's an inconvenience for me. So that's hugely different. That's a big change, and we're not taught that. I was never taught that at all. And even when you take programming classes, the assumption is not that a programming class could apply to anything in your real life. It's taught as a job, and so you're taught, or at least the one or two programming classes that I did take, you're taught like Java and how to do like payroll or you know, something like a database. Well, I was never really taught database, but you know, I mean, stuff like that, like very specific kind of like office work oriented kinds of things. No one ever mentions that, hey, there are things that you can do in your life to improve your workflow without any effort at all. It's just, you know, it's simple. You can learn how to talk to a computer. That needs fixing, really. People need to understand that computers are not just appliances and that they are tools that they can use to help them through like their everyday life, whatever they're doing. And they don't need to know, it's not because, it's not even an anti-consumer thing for me. It's that these computers are going to start to stagnate if we let everyone in the world decide that nothing should change. Because sometimes things do need to change, you know? I mean, progress needs to be made. Again, I'm the first to admit that sometimes developers try to change things just for the sake of changing things. It's not really about improvement, it's just kind of like, it's almost their own personal improvement. It's kind of their personal, like, can I go to the next level in my code? And that's fair on some level. Whether or not your distribution should be shipping it into your desktop, that's a question for you and your distro to work out privately in the privacy of your own home or place of worship or whatever. But, I mean, in terms of changing things, we need to be able to make improvements to what we're using. We need to continue to progress and make improvements. And I mean, ideally, the way I'm saying it is, yeah, they would actually be improvements. And I'm keenly aware that not all improvements actually improve anything. But assuming that we're talking about actual improvements, I would hate to be held back by the legendary grandmother computer user who's been using the same OS since 1968. Actually, that'd be pretty cool. But anyway, you know, like that user who's still on XP or whatever and just can't accept any kind of change, that's a drag. And I would rather have the freedom in technology to progress, to keep going forward. So how do we fix this? One of the solutions, I think, to this sort of resistance is... and by the way, if you're not picking up on it, I'm implying that Linux and open source is a driving force of change. So that's the subtext here. So one of the ways to fix the resistance to change, I think, are you and me, the noobs of the world. And if you don't consider yourself a noob, then exclude yourself, point to someone else who is a noob. And, you know, noobs are, I mean, it's not easy to be a noob, right? You have to reset all of your knowledge. You thought you knew something, and suddenly you realize you know nothing. And the positive side of that is that the more you try, the more you bang your head against the desk or the wall, really the better you get. And you're reversing the process of having not learned. And it's hard because you feel like you really did know a lot. And then you're staring at this new operating system that is exposing everything to you. And you realize you knew nothing at all along. And that's a scary place to be. It's uncomfortable. It slows you down. You start to question your own sanity. You start to believe that maybe all Linux users are lying to you, that Linux doesn't actually work, and they don't actually use it full time. They're just like, it's a conspiracy. But eventually, you know, when you accept that computer usage, that using a computer, you know, the act of using a computer involves learning new things constantly, then that's when you join the culture of learning, And that's a powerful place to be, because you're improving yourself, like, every time you turn on your computer, practically. And believe me, most computer users are living a lie. It's not as simple as their OS tells them it is. Deep down, I think the power users know it. I think there's, you know, there's this time where you're just using a computer, and you are just a dumb user, and you know that. You're a dumb user. You know a couple of tricks. You can do a couple of things. Maybe you can install an update. Maybe not. And then you start creeping up into that power usage place where geeks go. And, you know, deep down, I think you do know that something is missing. You're just not quite sure what. I mean, I know that's where I was for a very long time, right before I found Linux. It was just, I just knew that there was something that someone hadn't thought of yet, you know? And I thought, I can't be the only person to have seen that there's a real limit here as to what I, as a geek, can do. And yeah, there was. There was a huge limit, and people had noticed it, and Linux had been developed, I don't know, 10 years before, or 12 years before, or 15 years before, I don't know. A long time. So, you know, there's this real sense of power when you start to really, really learn the tool set that you have, you know, and what's behind all that computing power that's in just a laptop or a desktop or whatever. You start understanding it a lot more. You start understanding how the computer works, what you can make it do, how to talk to it. And that's really an important place for a power user to be. But I don't think it necessarily needs to be a power user. I do believe that, you know, not everyone needs to be a power user. Not everyone needs to hunger and thirst for computer knowledge the way Linux geeks tend to. But, I mean, not everyone can do that. This is a big world, and there's a lot of diverse needs and interests and wants, and we need all that stuff, obviously. We don't want everyone to be a nerd who just sits there and writes code all day or plays around with different distros all day or whatever. But I do believe people can be informed users. And right now I see dumb users and I see power users. And there's no block in there for just like an informed user, someone who knows what's going on, who understands what they are using. It's just like you've got like these two extremes. It's almost like, you know, the proverbial sort of like extreme poverty and extreme wealth. That's sort of all you have at this point. And we need that sort of middle class, I guess, of people who understand computers and use it. Maybe they don't like it, maybe they don't love it, but at least they understand. And I like to think that that did exist at some point, or maybe it was a target at some point. But it feels like, you know, I've seen old, like, AT&T documentaries on Unix, and they're talking about how stringing commands together enables the user to essentially write their own applications on the fly.
What Ryan did earlier was he typed all the commands, the five program names, for his spelling checker on one line using the pipeline facilities. Now that's nice, except that you may want to check documents often, and you don't want to have to type that long sequence of commands. So it's possible to put all of these commands in a file and tell the shell, when I type the name of that file, I want you to execute the commands that are inside that file. Now let me show you an example of this. We have a program called Spline, which fits curves to a set of data points, and I've got a set of five data points that we're going to see what the curve looks like. I'm going to run Spline through a program that turns this into graphics called Graph, and I'm going to run that through a special program that turns the graphic language into something specific for this terminal. I only need to type plot and data, because inside the file plot is this string of commands. And here is the result of plotting those five data points on this particular terminal.
That's right. I know that feeling. And that it felt like it was kind of harkening back to my early days in Linux when I was, you know, I didn't know a whole lot, but I knew the concepts, and I figured, okay, well, I can cat the output of this and pipe it into that and then echo it into this. I don't know why we would be doing all that, but you know, I mean, you know how to string these things together, and you start to pick up on little tricks, and suddenly you're just like this informed user, and you know how to talk to the computer, and things are happening, and it's just such a power trip. It's really, really nice. So, Linux, open source, it encourages that sort of thing. I mean, it just does. It's why it's open. It's open, and it exposes all that stuff for you. And as much as you want to learn, you can. There's no limit there. I mean, sure, there's a learning curve and barriers to entry, sort of, not really. But the essence of it is open. And if you get curious enough about some aspect of it, you can look, you can learn. You can ask someone. I think there's a tendency to think of, like, evangelism and stuff, you know? Like, oh, we need to promote Linux. We need to spread the word about Linux. We need to tell other people about Linux. That's not really what it's about. You can find people advertising their wares everywhere you look. I mean, it's kind of like that's what we specialize in at this point on this planet. We can advertise. We can market. We're good at that. The thing that I don't think anyone will ever really, really get down fully is the concept that actions speak louder than words. So you can market something all you want. You can support it. You can love Linux all you want. But the minute you go somewhere and show someone how to do something on anything that is not Linux, all that support and all that love and all that interest in Linux, and you know, you can shout that you're really fond of Linux. If you're using something else, then that's negating everything that you say. I'm not saying you know, obviously at some point you're going to have to use another operating system to show someone how to check their email or something. I get that. I'm just saying, as much as possible, I think the pro Linux users, the serious Linux users who proclaim themselves as Linux users, we need to make sure that we're showing people Linux in action when we get the chance. And I'm saying this only, of course, because it's happened to me recently. And it kind of opened my eyes, because there were a couple of times where there was a choice, you know? It was like, well, it's really super convenient right now to pick up this laptop that's running some other OS, so let's just do that. Or we could take this generic laptop here, stick a USB thumb drive into it, which I like literally carry around with me. It's a Slax thumb drive. I got it for $25 on slax.org, com, whatever. And reboot into Linux, and then I'll show you on the OS that I know. And it's not as convenient because it requires a reboot, and it requires this, and it's a little bit nerve-wracking because, I mean, geez, Linux never fails me, but it's a live demo, so everything's going to fail me. And honestly, I've done this kind of thing, it seems like a couple of times in the past couple of months. I mean, it's just, it's happened a lot. And there's just been this, you know, it's almost like I can visualize it. Like, there's this point in the road, and it's this fork, and I can go either the convenient, easy way, or I can kind of be the difficult guy and say, okay, I'm going to use Linux right now. And people are like, oh, geez, he's got to do his computer thing. And so I do the computer thing, and it boots into Linux, and they see whatever we were looking at, and it works like a charm, and it's just that simple. It's not like, I told you so. It's not like, we could have never done that on another OS. It's just the fact that, look, this is the OS that I use. I happen to prefer it because it respects my data, and it stays, you know, all the source code is open. I can I know that I'll always own this stuff. And it's made by my friends. The people I know and talk to online made this thing. And also, I helped make some of these packages that we're using right now. I mean, that's a big deal, and it's not something that we should be ashamed of. If you're involved in any way with making Linux happen, use it. It's yours. You helped make it, and you should be proud of that. And other people should respect that you're proud of that. Because they didn't make their OS. They're not allowed to help with their OS. I mean, maybe they are able to contribute to some third-party things, but generally speaking, yeah, it's not theirs. They don't own it. They might be sending code, but they don't own all of the code. So I carry Linux in my pocket. It's with me no matter what. I reboot to it off of a thumb drive when necessary. I get that thing shown. I get it out in front of people, and it works. And it speaks volumes, I think. So that's those are things that we can do, I guess, to fix this issue that change is a scary and bad thing. We can promote open source, and we can promote something that people can use to better learn and better understand computers as things, as tools. And if they start to do that, then change becomes a lot less frightening, because there's always the ability to just go do your own thing, or to change what you don't like, or to take control of it, to learn what you don't like, get to know it better, and start using it like a pro. Okay, I hope you got yourself a cup of coffee. I clearly did. So, I wanted to do the Noob Corner now, but actually first I just remembered that I meant to, before the coffee break, but I'll do it now instead. I wanted to give you an init script hack that I learned from linuxquestions.org, actually. This is a really, really cool little hack. Someone, clearly looked at the source code of this init system, which conveniently is just basically shell script, so it's all human readable. But I digress, or do I? And that is the fact that in Slackware, so this will be something that applies really to Slackware or BSD, possibly, but definitely Slackware. First, let me show you the normal boot time of this little virtual image. So I've got the virtual image set up pretty much stock Slackware. I'll start that in full screen. So this is the Lilo prompt. So from like this point on, this is how much time you would typically have to wait. Okay, so now I'll shut that down, and I'll show you what we can do to speed that up. So first I'll show you where those scripts are, and that is in /etc/rc.delta. And as you can see here, we've got a lot of little scripts, rc.whatever, and many of them are marked executable. The ones with little asterisks by them are executable. The white ones are not executable, meaning that they do not run. Now, by default, the rc.inet series usually gets run. All those get run except the conf file. And I don't run those because I don't really particularly need them. I'm using Wicked to manage my network here on my desktop, so I don't bother. And then the rc.wireless script I also do not run at boot because I don't need that. Let's see, there's rc.inet M, which is this guy here, which we should take a look at. The rc.m script is the multi-user script, meaning that it basically kicks in when we're in a multi-user init level, and I'll show you those in a minute. So if you kind of look through here, you see that it consists of a bunch of if-else statements. And the computer, as it boots, processes each one and figures out, do I need to take action on this, you know, depending on whether the test succeeds or fails. So in some cases where I kind of knew that, you know, I do or do not want something to happen, I went in and actually took out the if statements, just because I figured maybe a little bit less processing would speed things up. But the real ones that ended up being of interest are these cache updates. So the font cache update and some GTK updates, which I've actually commented out here, because in my final version of all this, I don't use the if statements. The icon cache update and the MIME database update. All those things, I figured, they don't really need to happen necessarily if I'm booting into a session that I'm not going to be launching a GUI environment. So I'm going to cut these out of this file and save that, and then I'm going to create a new file called rc.caches. And into rc.caches, I'll paste in everything that I just now took out of rc.m. We also need to put a line in here. In fact, I think, let me see if I have what I think we have. I believe I have a file in my temp. Yes, I do. Okay, cool. So this is the version that I had on my host machine. I just copied it over here. So I give a little bit of attribution to the author and a link so that when I forget what on earth all this is about, I can go look at it. And there's this log line just so that we know that it actually happened. And really, we could call it caches log or RC caches log, whatever. I've also inserted this echo statement just for our own use here. So we're not going to see this echo, but we should at some point, once all of this happens, we should see, I'm going to save this, we should see that the RC caches got run. And that'll dump itself into a temp file. So then we've got all of the different, the font update. I guess we really don't need these commented out sections, to be honest. Get rid of that. So we simplified the icon update simply because there were a lot of if-else statements, which I just happened to know resolved to true, so I'm going to just keep going with that. And if a boot ever fails, it's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, if it fails so badly that it won't even boot to any prompt at all, I could just boot off of a live disk. I'm not really too concerned about it. Or a Slax thumb drive. So the MIME database update, doing that as well, and again, I've kind of simplified it. And then these GTK things are simplifications of some other things that I took out somewhere as well. And then there's this driver for game controller that I go ahead and stick in here, which is probably really, really the wrong place to put it, but that's what I did. So do as I say, not as I do. Okay, so that's the rc.caches thing, and I guess we could also call it like rc.gui or something, because really that's the crux of all of this, that it's only going to start if we're booting into the GUI. It's not going to start at all if we don't chmod it to be executable, so we'll do that now, and we just did that. And then the only thing left to do is to add a line in the init tab, because otherwise this thing doesn't get run at all. So we'll add a line here, and we'll tell it to update caches. Okay, so the way that you do that is you tell it that this is a script that is going to be run on run level 4,
And again, if you need to see the run levels as they occur in Slackware, they're here at the top of init tab. So 0 is halt, 1 is single, 2 is unused, but basically it's 3, and 3 is multi-user mode without X, 4 is multi-user mode with X. So that's important to know. So then we'll say, when we get to run level 4, run this once. We don't need to continue to respawn it as they have here, the respawn. We don't need it to monitor and respawn if it stops, because we understand that it's going to stop. So we'll update rc.caches. And what we're going to do is we'll change our init script to 4. And, yeah, I guess that'll be it. So let's just make sure that we don't have an old log in here. We do, so I'm going to remove that. And then I'm going to reboot. So here we are at the Lilo prompt, and I'll just hit return. There you go. That was the boot sequence. Now it's kicking into X, and we are ready to log in.
That's nifty. I don't know. I don't care about boot times, to be honest. But I mean, obviously, I do enough to. I mean, I was curious as to what this did, the little hack that I just showed you. So that's why I tried it, and it seems to be working. So I'm not going to change it back. But I mean, honestly, I was never on board the whole, oh, we need faster boot times. I don't care. If it takes a couple of extra seconds to boot, I have a couple of extra sips of coffee to take. It's not really that big of a deal to me. But it's still, I mean, the hack itself is really cool, because it was someone who learned about their init system, looked at it, came up with a way of improving it, and just did it. It was that easy. Very, very cool. So, noob corner now. In this one, I want to talk about foreign characters, or I should say special characters, because every character is foreign to someone, but all characters are special to everyone. Special characters on a keyboard or on a computer system, generally, that just means it's a character that you want to type on the screen that does not appear on the printed version of your keyboard. So, if you want to type something that's not on your keyboard, the keyboard represents, generally speaking, the ASCII set of characters, and that's, you know, a set of codes, and there's only, I don't know, what, 128 or something? I don't know, I could be totally wrong about that. There's only so many ASCII characters, though. So someone invented Unicode, which encompasses a lot more than ASCII. The problem is that there are so many that a keyboard really still can't contain them all. And if they printed all those characters on the keys, it would get very, very confusing and messy. And I have seen a foreign keyboard at one point with some really interesting characters on it. I have it somewhere around here. I don't see it right now. It was on a laptop that I had gotten from someone. It was a broken laptop, supposedly. And it turns out that there was a loose wire on the inside that I had to reconnect, and then the keyboard itself was kind of screwed up, so I had to replace that. But it was well worth it. It was, I think, $20, $30 total for a totally fine laptop. So that was kind of neat. But yeah, it had foreign characters like printed, and it had like, I think, three different E's on the E key, and a few different ones on the I, you know, things like that. Either way, you have to somehow get access to those foreign characters. And on some operating systems, the one that I used to use, you just hit the Alt key, or they called it Option, and then some other character. And sometimes there were other characters that you could get with Alt, Shift, and then character. And it was that action. It was Alt, Shift, whatever, you know, and so it was just like a Control-C, Control-V, except it was alt whatever or alt shift whatever. So in my mind, that was how you accessed special characters. It took me so long to understand that not everyone did it that way. That was the main thing for me. Like, I think I probably had this whole system figured out, like, the first year of using Linux. It just was too ingrained in me to hit that, like that. And that's not how it's done on Linux. The way that it's done on Linux is you press whatever key. It's not alt, so we'll just call it compose. So you hit the compose key, and then you release, and then you press some letter, and then another letter. So that compose key press puts you into some sort of place, special limbo, and then you hit a character and another character. Those two combine and produce a special character, a Unicode character. That's how it's done. So here's how to configure it, and here you can see it also in action. Let's get some screen capture here.
So the ways to set what we call the compose key or the multi underscore key. That's what the two terms that we're dealing with here. One is in the system settings. Now in KDE, the system settings looks like this, and in GNOME, they're going to look like something else, and whatever desktop you're using might do this differently. Don't freak out, there's another way to do this no matter what desktop you're using, but generally speaking, no matter what desktop, this is what you're dealing with. The idea is you find where your keyboard settings are. Now, in KDE, don't be fooled by shortcuts and gestures. That's just to define shortcuts and gestures. No, this is the keyboard setting itself, which in KDE is the input devices in the keyboard category, in the third tab labeled advanced. So here we are in the advanced tab. Make sure that we can configure these extra keyboard options, and then add whatever behavior you want. And you can see in the video edition of this anyway, you can see that there is a compose key position item right here. So if I open that up, we see that we can set it to a lot of different things. Some of them are kind of weird to me, but you could set it for the caps lock, because who uses the caps lock? Although I have the caps lock set to be a control key myself, so that wouldn't work for me. But I could do it for the caps lock if I didn't use it for something else. You could do it for the right super key, which generally speaking will have either an Ubuntu logo or a Tux logo or a Windows logo on it. And you could do it for the scroll lock key, or what I do is the menu key. That's the one I use. Now you'll notice none of these are checked, and that's because I actually don't do it through this GUI interface at all. But if you did, then you would want to check that, hit apply, and you'd be good. So the other way to do it is to look at a file, or create a file rather, called .xmodmap, or that's traditionally what it's called. You could actually call it whatever you want, but we'll call it /.xmodmap, and there I have quite a few lines in there, but as you can see from, again, the video, or if you're just listening to this, then you'll hear it from me, the line that I have that is applicable to what we're doing here is key code space 135 space equals space multi underscore key, and the multi key again is synonymous for compose. That's the compose key. So how do I know that it is key code 135? Well, you've probably heard of this little program called Zev, X-E-V. If you launch it, then anything you do within the white little pop-up box that it gives you is recorded in your terminal. So I'll position my mouse over the white box, and then I'll hit the menu key a couple of times. And you can kind of see it on my screen, or if you try it at home, you'll see it, that you get feedback when you press the menu key down and when you release the menu key. So we'll scroll back up here. We'll get out of Zev so we can regain control of our keyboard. We'll scroll up a little bit. So this is, if you'll recall, this was the area, this paragraph here was the area that I hit the menu key during. I just want to kind of highlight it so you know what you're looking for, but you'll see it says key code 135. Now, it gets a little bit confusing because it gives you a lot of information. The serial code, the root code, the state code, the time at which you pressed it, whether it's released or depressed, you know, or an event, you know, whatever. A press event. So it gives you a lot of information. Just kind of try to filter that out and look for the keyword key code and then the number. That's what that is. So if you put that into a file, again, traditionally speaking, it's called .xmodmap, and so I've got key code space 135 equals multi-key. Okay, so now we load it into our environment, and the command for that is the xmodmap, and then the path to your xmodmap file. So in my case, it is xmodmap space tilde slash dot xmodmap. So now it's loaded, and we can actually start using this. So if I hit the compose key, for instance, I hit the dash and then the L, I get a pound key, a pound sign. If I hit compose and then two exclamation marks, I get an upside down exclamation mark like they use in Spanish. If I hit the compose key and the tilde and then the N, I get N with a tilde. And remember, I'm doing this all as a three key sequence. So now I'll hit the compose key and then shift double quote and then U, I get U with two dots over it. And then the compose key and then the X and then the X, I get a multiplication sign. So I've just spelt Linux in special characters. See? That's special characters in Linux. Now, if you need to see what you have available to you, like you want to see everything that you can possibly use, you can see that. It's on the internet, but it's also on your hard drive right now. So if you open up in some Unicode capable application the file at /usr/share/x11 with a capital X slash locale, that's local with an E at the end, slash whatever your locale is, so mine is en_us.utf-8, and then compose with a capital C, then you will see a file with all the different choices that you can possibly want to have, really. I mean, it just tells you everything that you've got on the system and how to make them. So, for instance, we've got a copyright symbol here, and it's telling us, well, if you do the multi-key and then the O and then the C, then you'll get the copyright symbol. So let's test that out. Let's open, for instance, Abby Word, and this is officially the most time I've spent in an Office application in years, officially, and I've only just opened it. Okay, so we've got multi-key O C. Sure enough, that gives us a copyright symbol. So let's see what else we've got to play around with. Of course, there's the registered mark, with just R in a circle. So as you can see, those are fairly intuitive. Like, you can kind of think, I mean, you could even guess, probably. Like, if I were to ask you, what do you think the Unicode for trademark symbol would be? Well, that would be, of course, the multi-key, and then the T, and then the M. And sure enough, that gives you a trademark symbol. Or if you were trying to think of the Unicode symbol for a fraction, you might think, oh, well, that would probably be the compose key, and then the 1, and then the 2, for instance. And that would give you a fraction of 1/2, instead of, you know, writing it out. Or compose 1/4, and that gives you 1/4, and so on. The double S character in German, the looks like a big capital B to us Americans. So that would be, since it translates roughly to the double S sound, so it would be multi-key SS, and that gives you the that weird sort of B symbol that sounds sort of like an S, apparently. That's what I've been told. So yeah, you've got lots of things like that. You've got like a degrees symbol. Like, if you're thinking of, you know, like 21 degrees, that's multi-key OO. So a lot of them are memorable. Some of them are less memorable. One is really simple. Do you know what the heart symbol would be? Why, yes, it would be multi-key less than and then 3. And that gives you the heart symbol. Okay, so here I am in Fluxbox. So I just wanted to kind of demonstrate really quickly how this all actually works even without a desktop environment. So I'll start Abby Word again, for instance. And I mean, I haven't done anything off screen. All I did was log out and log back in. So as you can see, the characters are still working right here in good old Fluxbox, and that's without any kind of desktop specific thing happening at all. So it just doesn't matter what you don't have to have a fancy desktop system going on or anything. It can be anything, really. And it you can't really see it on this screen, but it's working in URXVT, it works in console, it works in Abby Word. It's system wide, you know, it's Unicode, so it's happening all over the place.
And that's special characters on Linux. It's really, really easy, I think you'll agree. I was pleasantly surprised when I finally got the key sequence. It's the key sequence. I don't know if it's just me me and other people who used to use the same OS that I used to use prior to Linux. Just get it out of your head that it's going to be like a Control-C, Control-V type of thing. It's compose, and then something, and then something. That'll clear it up for you. Okay, so I want to talk about Dvorak, just to kind of keep with the keyboards, I guess. So this is not a noob corner thing. This is more for everyone. You probably have heard of the Dvorak keyboard, maybe. The legend goes that this guy named Dvorak was brought in to study efficiency in typewriters. And one of the things that he noticed was that you could rearrange the keys and teach people to type much faster. I mean, they'll learn faster, but they will also end up typing faster with this new arrangement. And what he was doing was grouping things together in not necessarily a logical order, but on a usefulness principle. So like all the vowels, which we use all the time, are all on the left hand on the home row. And then the letters that are, you know, most frequently used otherwise are on the right hand on the home row. And then you kind of move out in both directions in terms of the frequency of things. So about, I don't know, a couple of months ago now, I finally decided that I was going to absolutely switch to Dvorak, because I'd been meaning to do it for ages, and I just hadn't ever found a time that was convenient to do that. And one thing that I was noticing about a lot of the work I was doing here lately is that for instance, programming. Like, if you're writing something, writing a book, then your fingers have to flow as fast as your brain does. You know, you need that speed, or otherwise there's like a bottleneck and you're thinking faster than you can type, and then you just start thinking and you don't type because it's inefficient to type. So switching to Dvorak under that condition is basically impossible. I've tried it. But programming, where you're not necessarily, or at least I'm not necessarily, you know, I'm not writing like 140 characters a minute or a second, either of those really. And you know, because you're putting this logic together, and so you're typing more like, you know, as you think of the logic of it. And I found that that was a lot easier to learn Dvorak on, because I didn't need that instant kind of speed and everything. So I switched to Dvorak just for those things, like the things that I was doing, and for a good month I was doing a lot of programming, some web stuff, but none of it was like that creative kind of like writing something down and, you know, full sentences and stuff. It was more like phrases and tags and things like that, keywords. So I started, you know, here's what I did. The first week, maybe, I didn't switch to Dvorak, but I did lessons. I found a Dvorak typing tutor online, and it was, you know, you just, it takes you through each, all the different ones, and it's a typing tutor, and it was free, it was online, and there's a dozen of them out there. Just go hunt one down. You'll find one if you're interested in this. And so I practice, I want to say an hour, maybe 2 hours every morning for a week. And then I think the second week, yeah, it might have been a full 2 weeks, to be honest, where I just did the typing tutor stuff for like 2 hours in the morning. And then maybe on the third week or so, I would switch over to Dvorak for certain tasks. Now, then I found that trying to switch back and forth was just too hard. So I basically just said, okay, it's going to be Dvorak all day. So I did that, and it was a little bit difficult and a little bit frustrating. And I would say it was frustrating probably for about 2 or 3 weeks, full 2 or 3 weeks. It was really, really hard not to switch back to QWERTY and just give up on Dvorak. But one keyboard, which is down there somewhere, I did the whole, you know, pop the keys and rearrange them into Dvorak. And another one, I didn't want to do that on because I don't trust the ability of the keys to go back on, really. So I just printed out a cheat sheet and had that by my computer. And I don't know, I'd say by the fifth or the sixth week, I was totally fine with Dvorak. It's not all I use because I have access to a lot of computers around here that don't have Dvorak and will not have Dvorak because other people need to use them. But in terms of like my systems, I'm generally using Dvorak, I'd say almost exclusively. Sometimes I switch back and forth. I'm not really clear on why, to be honest. I think it's just because I forget to switch it over to Dvorak or something. I'm not sure. But it's nice. I mean, first of all, I would say it's a little bit maybe overrated, honestly. I mean, I hate to say that because I'm using it, but I think looking back, I do think that I felt like it would be much more of an epiphany kind of moment, you know, and like, just, oh my gosh, I can't believe I ever used anything but Dvorak. It's kind of take it or leave it, to be honest. I mean, I don't want to discourage you from learning it if you want to learn it, but I will say that it hasn't utterly changed my life. It's nice, I do enjoy it, but I don't feel like it's completely, it hasn't changed my life like Linux changed my life. You know, it's not that kind of thing. It's more just like KDE versus GNOME or something like that. You know, it's just, no, that might even be better. I mean, KDE trumps GNOME pretty solidly. Maybe like, maybe it would be more like Fluxbox versus OpenBox. You know, Fluxbox is a lot nicer, but, you know, OpenBox will do in a pinch, that kind of thing. I've made some people angry with that, and I'm glad for that. So anyway, yeah, it's nice. I mean, it's cool, it's fun, it is nice. And there is a certain flow to it once you start typing. Here's the thing about it, and this is probably why it's not like a life-changing thing, because, and this ties into change again, it's just that modern computing has so many, and I mean, not even like very modern computing. I'm talking about like even Emacs, for instance. I mean, on a Dvorak keyboard or on a normal keyboard, to hit Control X, Control C, for instance, it's just, you know, you move your finger over to the caps lock, which you've got mapped to Control, obviously, and then your finger down to X and then down to C, and it's kind of like, you know, it's like this movement that you've got down. But on the Dvorak, it's like caps lock and then where B would be, or is it V? no, B, I think, or N. That's another thing about Dvorak. It really makes you feel, or realize rather, how bad of a touch typist you are. I used to think I was a great touch typist. I mean, I type fast, but I guess I must be cheating a lot more than I realize, because doing Dvorak, it's just like, I mean, if I don't have the keys swapped out, it takes a while to get back up into gear. And then conversely, if I've got the keys swapped to Dvorak and I'm like at the login screen at work, it doesn't have, you know, the Dvorak doesn't kick in until you're logged in, because I have it just going through I think KDE, just the KDE thing, I think. I might have done it with X, I forget. But either way, it doesn't kick in for KDM. Or is it XDM that we use? I think it's XDM. You're typing, and then it looks like Dvorak, so you have to type now in QWERTY, and I always mistype. I'm always mistyping. It's very confusing. So yeah, not a good typist, apparently. Anyway, point is, a lot of the keyboard mappings that exist, I feel like they were designed on a QWERTY keyboard, not surprisingly. And doing them on Dvorak, it does feel a little bit strange. That said, I've been enjoying Dvorak. Honestly, I have, I'm really kind of sticking with it, I guess, because I do apparently enjoy it. So I do recommend, like, if you're interested in it, you should learn it and you should try it out and see how it serves you. If you have no interest in it, to be completely honest, I'm not sure that there's a pressing need to learn Dvorak. It also makes you realize how often you use the letter X in Linux. You know? Like, really. In the Linux world, X reigns supreme. We use it for everything. And it's buried, like, in this sort of nebulous middle area, which is meant for, like, the rarest of letters. And I'm always getting it wrong. And it's just, yeah, you really learn how often you're typing the letter X in Linux.
That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Computer application developed involves a big team of people working in close coordination. So everybody in the computing business is constantly searching for ways to do a better job of developing computer applications. But there are some things that can be done to make life easier for everybody on a large programming project. And in the next few minutes, we're going to show you some of the properties of the Unix operating system.